Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Loudville, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Wilder. And today I have two great guests, Pat Rhodes and Dave Jonas. Now, Pat is a friend of mine, and Dave, you know, the more we get to know each other, I'm sure we're going to be great friends as well. But, you know, I've known Pat a while and had a chance to work with Pat. He spent his career as a program manager at NNSA. He's an engineer, so he thinks like an engineer. And Dave, of course, is an attorney and spent his career, you know, he was a Marine Corps JAG and worked on the joint staff and was the general counsel at NNSA. And he's now in private practice in DC. And Pat and Dave have been writing a series of articles in the Washington Times on nuclear issues. And so, of course, I thought, given their prolific writing, it was time to have them on to NucleCast. So welcome to the show, gents. Okay, so I wanted to discuss sort of three major things, and this one I'm sort of looking forward to because I have a hunch that we may not see eye to eye. So it's good that we're not going to have the Amen chorus out today. That always makes a NucleCast episode more interesting. And so let me ask you this question. You know, we've got a strategic environment in which the Russians have thousands more tactical and theater nuclear weapons than we do. They have suspended participation in New START, which makes it possible for them to, you know, upload thousands more weapons if they need to. And they have the capacity to build 1,000 pits a year, so they don't have our problems. For many of our listeners, they're all, you know, dispersed across the nuclear enterprise. So they know we can't produce 80 pits a year, whereas the Russians can produce 1,000. We've got the Chinese, who are building hundreds of new weapons per year in the delivery vehicles. They're clearly seeking parity. We've got the North Koreans who are now working. I mean, they just signed an agreement with the Russians, so we can expect that as part of North Korea's support to Russia in the Ukraine war, that Russia will probably provide fissile material and other support to the North Korean nuclear program. We've got in Iran, where I think over the weekend I heard that the Ayatollah said that he wanted nuclear weapons within a month. It was something to that effect. It was there was an article out in the last 5 days that said the Ayatollah made a statement of this kind. So we've got three, potentially four, nuclear armed adversaries that can outmatch us very clearly. The Russians alone outmatch us. So, interestingly, the disarmament community in the United States is sort of making a full court press to, you know, there's a whole bunch of new programs that Carnegie's funding. There's a new, you know, postdoc at MIT to look at the effects of low yield nuclear use. So there's this really full court press to try to advocate for disarmament in the United States. And given the strategic environment and all that's going on, let me ask you guys, is nuclear disarmament a wise idea now, in the future, at any point? Let me toss that over to you guys.
Well, I think nuclear disarmament it's a moral hazard. All you're doing is creating a situation where if you somehow got to a magical disarmament community or across the world by some magical imperative, you're creating a moral imperative. You're creating a moral hazard. Why? Because you're incentivizing the bad guys to go off and create nuclear weapons in secret overnight and wake up the next day as king of the hill. So you're creating a terrible situation that's grossly unstable, and it makes the world less safe. Everything else aside, it's just from a geopolitical perspective, a strategic balance, it's probably the worst possible outcome you can imagine.
I've said for a long time that I would love to see disarmament work if it were possible. And I'm a member of the Arms Control Association and a supporter of the Arms Control Association. I just attended their annual conference. And it's my hope that somebody there or in an organization like that can figure out how we get to nuclear disarmament. I'm certainly not smart enough to figure that out. But meanwhile, we have to deal with the real world and the real problems that exist. We face a situation for the first time in my career, which started in this business in 1997 as nuclear nonproliferation planner for the Joint Chiefs. Back then, all kinds of disarmament negotiations were in full swing. All kinds of treaty talks were in full swing. Treaties were being proposed and even starting to negotiate on the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, which has done absolutely nothing since 1998, when the Conference on Disarmament got about 2 weeks of actual negotiations on it. I was there for that. Since then, nothing. So it's a very difficult environment to begin arms control negotiations when you have, for example, the Trump administration wisely and appropriately trying to bring in China to a trilateral negotiation between the U.S., Russia, and China. And China basically giving the Heisman straight arm, saying, you know, we're not interested at all. How do you, and Russia, of course, in the middle of a war that had started with Ukraine and threatening the use of nuclear weapons. So in that kind of a strategic environment, with North Korea also ramping up its production and Iran very close to nuclear weapons capability, how in the world do you seriously begin real arms control negotiations? I don't see it.
Well, let me ask you sort of a more fundamental question, and that is, if, let's suppose hypothetically, we could disarm, everybody gets on board and agrees to it, we've now made the world safe for great power war again. And I've seen that in the 20th century. That was, you know, 70 to 90 million dead in World War One and Two. World War One led to the rise of Soviet communism. That killed another 50 million. And then World War Two led to the rise of Chinese communism, which killed another 50 plus million. And then, oh, you know, there's Laos and there's all these other places. There's a great book, if you've never seen it, it's an old book now, but it's called The Black Book of Communism. And it was written by six French communists who said, hey, you know, communism as it worked in the 20th century wasn't, it was bad. And they go through how many people died. And they said, but we'll do it right the next time. And so they were optimistic communists that you know, 100 million dead wasn't necessary. But I guess my fear, and then I saw, you know, at the height of World War II, we spent 50 cents of every American dollar on the war effort. And whereas with nuclear weapons, we spend a lot less on defense. If you look at average defense budgets, they're much lower on average with nuclear weapons than without them. So you've allowed America to prosper and have these things called iPhones and all this other stuff. So for anyone who says, I wish I could disarm or uninvent nuclear weapons, I say, you really don't actually want that world. That's a bad world. So let me challenge you, Dave. And this is where we have the opportunity to not have the amen chorus, which is a good thing. How would you deal with that world?
Well, I mean, look, I as I may have mentioned, I have my views could be considered somewhat schizophrenic. I mean, I'll be the first to tell you that without question, if you look at deaths in wars, you know, starting from the Middle Ages and ramping all the way up to World War II, where you had 60 million dead, and then all of a sudden you have the advent of nuclear weapons in 1945, the death toll is reduced at scale by the advent of nuclear weapons. So in that sense, nuclear weapons are responsible for dramatically reducing wars by deaths in wars by preventing essentially great power wars. And that has held, that firebreak has held now for about 80 years. And we certainly hope that it will continue to do so, although for the first time, we have a recognized nuclear weapons state under the NPT, Russia, actually threatening the use of nuclear weapons, continual threats. It's remarkable. No one's ever seen anything like it. So given this current strategic environment, it is very hard for me to say that disarmament is the right direction to move in, particularly if we have our enemy states like North Korea, China, and Russia, and I believe they are enemies at this point, ramping up their nuclear weapons production.
Yeah, That's a good point. It's, you know, V.I. Lenin once said that in order for him to achieve Soviet man, he would have to remake the human soul, such that it, you know, he believed that sort of the perspective that humans are fundamentally bad was true. And therefore part of his objective was to remake man into what he called Soviet man. And he said, absent the ability to do that, communism was never possible. And so I sometimes, you know, as I argue with my, you know, colleagues at the Bulletin, the Atomic Scientists and elsewhere, I sort of say, hey, listen, I understand your idealism. You know, we love idealists, but the problem is we, you know, that people are fundamentally wicked. They're not fundamentally good, or they're not fundamentally neutral. You know, people have a sin nature and they do things that are self-interested and bad, and absent the ability to change that, your objectives are not possible. And so I posit that because I know you guys have written about, you know, the issues of morality and nuclear weapons. And so I sort of throw this over to y'all in for me as a realist, challenging idealism. And it's, you know, should we even be idealists anymore? I offer that to, you know, what is the sort of the response, or what is the challenge back? Because I haven't really gotten a good one. I haven't gotten one that says, okay, you know what? I can see where you're coming from. So is there a sort of a good retort?
Well, the first piece Dave and I wrote was last August. It was in response to the Oppenheimer movie that came out last summer. A great movie, by the way. You can break out and see it if you haven't.
I think it's on Netflix now, or maybe Amazon Prime. Yeah.
Yeah, we saw it live. There's some scenes in there probably not necessary. That's an aside. But here I would say we wrote about the morality of nuclear weapons. I don't think anybody should argue that blowing up 100,000 people, or maybe closer to 200,000 people, is a moral action. The question is, what else could you have done instead? So the reality is morality has to be defined in the context of what is doable. So when Truman dropped those two bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, he did it with consciousness that, you know, a lot of people are going to suffer. But he also realized any other thing he was going to do, they're going to suffer equally too. So it wasn't like he was doing something better or worse. It was just the idea of, let's get out of this. This war has been so horrific. We got to get out of this once and for all and put an end to it. So it was a very conscious and deliberate statement that war is a bad thing. Let's end it now.
And let me just add to that, that of course we're coming up on August, where every year we see a revisionist history of the use of the nuclear weapons in World War II, and how what an awful thing it was, and of course we're about to re-enter that debate as we do every summer. I think that in that regard, the funny thing is no one ever talks about the firebombings of Tokyo and Dresden, which of course killed many more than the use of the nuclear weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What's the real difference there? Just that a nuclear weapon is a different kind of a thing. It took one nuclear bomb to cause those kinds of numbers of death, whereas who knows how many conventional weapons it took to firebomb Tokyo and Dresden and cause even more death. Which is better, which is worse? You know, it had to be done. What Truman was balancing against, of course, was the loss of potentially a million U.S. casualties. We are still, you know, a statistic that always amazes me is for the planning of the invasion of mainland Japan, given the horrific battles that occurred in the lead up to that in Guadalcanal, Okinawa, Saipan, Tinian, they produced about a million Purple Hearts for award to our troops who were going to either get killed or injured in that invasion. And apparently there were so many made that we are still giving those Purple Hearts out today.
Yeah. Wow. That's I had never heard the part about Purple Hearts. I know, you know, a lot of people challenge that there were going to be these massive casualties for advocates of nuclear disarmament. They like, oh no, that would have never happened. You know, the Japanese were broken. There's actually a couple of really good books. And I think one of them was written by, I'm drawing a blank on his name, but he was the historian at DOE or NNSA. And he wrote a great book maybe 10 or so years ago that really goes into the detail of Japanese planning and what they were thinking. And then, you know, sort of a second part that's just an interesting thing I never hear mentioned is, you know, so the height of burst that of the bombing at Hiroshima was, you know, that was 15 kilotons-ish. And that height of burst was about 1,400 feet, 1,500 feet. So the fallout-free height of burst for that size of a weapon is about 700 to 800 feet. So it was more than high enough that, you know, that fireball did not touch the ground and suck up debris and deposit irradiated debris. Most of the destruction, about 80% actually, was, you know, the fire that was caused because, you know, the buildings were made out of wood and paper. And so, you know, the thermal radiation caught stuff on fire, and then, you know, and it caught it on fire within less than 1,000 yards of the ground zero. And then it spread for more than 4 miles, and it was just that fire. So it effectively started the fire like a normal conventional firebombing. And then because of the way the Japanese built their buildings, it spread. And that's where almost all of the destruction came from. It wasn't the actual nuclear detonation. And that's one of those things that when we talk about weapons effects, people seem to get weapons effects terribly wrong. And so I sort of wish we did more to educate the American public on actual weapons effects instead of, you know, letting imaginations run wild. So that's a side note. You know, we're at the time of the show where I have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want you guys to talk about our deterrent. Has it weakened? Is it strengthening? Where are we on that? You're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Amlaw Deterrent Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Pat Rhodes and Dave Jonas. And they've been writing a series of articles in the Washington Times. You know, Pat's an engineer and program manager. Dave's an attorney and, you know, former Marine. I don't know how the Marines get involved in nuclear planning, but Dave did. And he was an attorney at the time. He was a JAG. And so a Marine JAG doing nuclear planning on the Joint Staff. I think you might be the only one that I know of that did that. So, you know, maybe you were just an ambitious Marine, which all Marines are ambitious, but still. So I posited a question to you before the break. Are we in decline? Are we on our way up? Where are we?
Oh, in my view, we're absolutely in the wrong path. We stacked everything on top of everything else. We now have all five legs of the nuclear complex are in disarray and all have to be rebuilt all at the same time. That's the three legs of the triad: nuclear command and control and the NNSA weapons complex. We put those off and we put them off and we put them off. Now they're all on top of each other. Basically, we have no chance of recovering and being successful and rebuilding the deterrent we had before. A chance of a big project being successful is like 37%, and nuclear is probably worse than that. If you string those numbers together, you got to realize there's just no way we're going to get all that done in the next 15 years. It just is not going to happen because of poor planning.
Yeah, let me just back up for 1 second to tell you there is one Marine. Of course, the Marines and the Army now have no nuclear weapons, but Marine Corps does have one spot for a JAG on the Joint Staff, basically for treaty negotiation, nuclear treaty negotiation. So that's somehow I landed up in that spot, and I'm glad I did, because it certainly set me on this path to stay engaged in this area. But I just have vivid memories, you know, as the NNSA General Counsel, of touring all the nuclear facilities in the nuclear complex pretty much every year, and seeing, you know, when I would make my visits to the sites, visit the council, I'd also see the complex. I have some vivid memories of the complex really desperately needing renovation, seeing some areas where that had been literally unchanged since World War II, since the Manhattan Project, hadn't been renovated at all. Now, maintenance was continually deferred. at some point, you can only do that for so long. And there was a realization several years ago that we can't defer this stuff any longer. Well, that's a long time to wait. And then you're playing catch-up ball. As Pat pointed out, that's kind of where we are. That's why we're behind the eight ball on all this stuff. We've got a long way to go to catch up. And as Pat has also noted, we're sort of just in the early stages of modernizing our nuclear complex, while the Russians and the Chinese are in the completion stages of their modernization program.
Let me ask you this. This is a question nobody ever gives me a good answer to, that I've been looking for a good answer. So I saw an article that came out. It was a critical article of nuclear modernization, and said we're spending $70 billion a year and we can't afford it. Now, as I've pointed out many a times, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services says that they lose about $100 billion a year in the Medicare Medicaid budget to waste, fraud, and abuse every year. Now, I've never met a person who said, oh yeah, I knew that, and that's just unacceptable. I've never met that person. Nobody even knows that Medicare and Medicaid lose $100 billion a year. But yet somehow that's not worthy of any care or consideration. But yet the $70 billion on nuclear is just can't afford it. And then I could go, that they estimate the federal government loses $1 trillion a year to waste, fraud, and abuse every year, even in good years. The $6 trillion that was spent on COVID, they estimate $4 trillion was lost to waste, fraud, and abuse. And a majority of it, they say, went to waste, fraud, and abuse to non-Americans overseas who were able to steal it. And so I guess whenever I hear people say that nuclear modernization is unaffordable, I'm just like, what is your standard of measure? Is your standard of measure any money spent on nuclear is unaffordable? Or is there an objective standard of measure in which you say things are affordable or not? Because I'm pretty familiar with the federal budget. I know how we spend money and I know how much we lose to different forms of waste, fraud, and abuse. So I don't know how anyone can objectively say it's unaffordable. Am I wrong?
Oh, I think the way to look at it is, how much would you have to pay if you didn't have a nuclear deterrent? What would you pay in terms of marine divisions and aircraft carriers and armies? By all measures, nuclear weapons are cheap defense. And by the way, that's not a revelation that came in the 21st century. General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, came to that reality back in the 1950s. He realized he couldn't keep up with the Russians and conventional capabilities in Europe. What did he rely upon? He relied upon Strata-4s to get him there with his nuclear capabilities. It was just simply much cheaper. I mean, you wouldn't think that national defense should hang on to money. To put that in perspective, we are now paying more in debt service on the national debt than we are paying for national security. So talk about poor planning. As I mentioned before, that's an example of the worst kind of planning. Keep pushing costs forward and getting nothing for it. The national debt's not a discussion here, but the reality is the analogy is very clear. If you keep pushing things off to the right and pushing off to the right, eventually the day of reckoning bites you in the butt.
It does, and I appreciate your scene setting there, Adam. I mean, when I begin to teach my class every year, I ask my students, what do you see as the main national security threats? And typically the students respond with military things. And even though I ask them to think broadly, quite frankly, aside from this nuclear stuff, my main concern in terms of our national security is the debt. And I do think that we're at an inflection point where the interest on the debt has gotten now greater than the defense budget, where we see how great empires and great civilizations have declined, and it is a risk that we are truly about to confront, and some tipping point could occur, like another downgrading of our credit. I don't want to get off on that tangent, but it is a huge, huge risk. But to get back to your question, I do think that when people have their own axes to grind or their own personal issues against nuclear weapons or against fill in the blank, when they look at a large budget and look at what to cut, they point to the thing that they are against. And often that can be nuclear weapons. It seems like an obvious target to a lot of people, but as Pat noted, it's a fairly efficient expenditure of funds.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, when we talk about, let's say, Sentinel, there, you know, there's a re-attack on the Sentinel because of its, you know, and I sometimes wonder, I'm like, hey, we built these things once in the early 1960s, you know, because the problem isn't the missile. We've got the missile down. It's on time. It's on target. The problem is the infrastructure and all of the modernization. And that's one of the things we did once. And now we're trying to go back to those holes, you know, 65 years later and modernize them. And we're getting it right. Oh, and we're doing it over the course of 50 years. I don't know. I don't know any economist whom I can say, hey, you project the cost of something 50 years from now. And if you get it wrong, you're getting punished. No economist will say, yeah, I can do that. No problem. And so we're asking the impossible, you know, to accurately get it. And I, you know, but it's just one of those things that seems to be a popular thing to do. And so I wonder, did you guys have any sort of thoughts on the Sentinel issue? Because it's really hot right now, as you guys know.
Well, I'll give you my view as a program manager, because Dalen actually had this discussion after we wrote an article that Sentinel thing just broke out. And we predicted what's going to happen in Congress and in the press and elsewhere. There's going to be cannibalism. They're going to start raiding the budget. They're going to put more requirements on it. The worst possible solution to a project that's suffering problems with funding is to starve it of funding. If you're going to make a bad situation worse, if that's the model you follow, you will kill that project if you keep squeezing it, and you'll cannibalize the Sentinel for Ohio missiles or whatever else in the Trident. It's going to happen that one's going to take the place of another, and you're going to lose the capability to maintain a triad.
And indeed, looking more broadly at that issue, when I see the attacks on the Sentinel, I also see it as an argument to remove one leg of the triad. In other words, how are we going to save money? Let's remove one leg of the triad. And those who argue that will say, look, the submarine leg is invulnerable. Well, it's not invulnerable. The Chinese are gaining in acoustic sonar array intelligence. And if they figure out a way, and they may have done this already, we really don't know, to detect our nuclear submarines, then that leg is not invulnerable. So you really need three legs of the triad. We're not Britain, you know. We're not going to go to two legs or one leg, and we need the Sentinel as a significant and important leg of the triad.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're getting short on time. So before we run out of time, I wanted to bring out my good friend Bob the Genie, and so as I rub my magic lamp, Bob grants three wishes. Now I'm going to do something special because Bob and I talked before the show and he said, you each get three wishes. So Pat, let me start with you for your wish number one.
All right. I'm going to keep them topical here, Adam, at your suggestion. I think there are three problems or three wishes I would have. Is first of all, we got to check the vision of modernization. We got to improve where we are on that. Today's vision really lacks leadership. It's not really serious. It doesn't have any sense of urgency. It's kind of, well, let's get along and get it done when we can kind of thing. That is not how you win the game. So in my view, you got to change the vision of modernization. Number two is we need to change the acquisition approaches. Our acquisition approaches are way too risk averse. We're trying to save pennies by spending dollars to do it. And it's all about being reactive instead of proactive. So we need to change our acquisition approach. And the last one is a project program manager. I think we need to change the way we do business there, Adam. And first of all, we need to quit treating our program and project managers as advocates. Let them manage their projects. Don't allow them to advocate. That's the responsibility of politics. We should have our program managers or project managers authorized to make real decisions to make their projects and programs successful. Unfortunately, that's not how we're configured. And related to that, the last piece is we got to get past trying to managing projects and programs by managing the costs. You got to manage the task. If you do that, you'll manage the schedule. And if you'll do that, you'll manage the cost. We invert that pyramid and try to do it by cost, and it will fail every time. So those are my three wishes for you, Adam.
Well, it's interesting you say that because, you know, if you think about the way government works, so private industry is successful when you do more for less. A federal agency is successful when it does less and gets more to do it. So, you know, success is the exact opposite in the federal government. Did you know that in the history of the federal government, there's only ever been one instance in which a federal agency said, we're no longer needed, you need to shut us down? You know what that example was? The Civil Aeronautics Board that used to regulate prices on airline tickets. And the prices, that was in the, you know, mid-1970s, and it's cheaper to fly today than it was, you know, than 1976. The prices are still, the actual real prices are still lower today than they were in the 70s. And so it did exactly what it was meant to do by shutting it down. But that's the only ever instance of government trying to be efficient and do the right thing. So now let me go over to you, Dave. So Bob has granted you three wishes as well. So now you've got a top Pat, and you got to have even better wishes than Pat. I liked yours, Pat, because we've never had a program manager make wishes. So program management wishes are good ones. Those are new wishes for Bob to deal with. So Dave, how about you?
Sure. Well, mine will be in the legal area, of course. And there's always this risk of the NPT falling apart. It's been kind of a, something the arms control crowd has been worried about for years. They worried about it, particularly where North Korea pulled out. But it's held so far. But I think there is kind of widespread acknowledgement that if Iran pulls out and tests a nuke, that you'll see a rapid spread of nuclear, of states with nuclear weapons, such as Turkey, Egypt, the UAE, Saudi Arabia. If that happens, the NPT is as good as dead. So my first wish is that the NPT will hold. I think it's a valid treaty, a good treaty. It's served us and the world well, and I hope it holds. The second wish would be that the TPNW, the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, actually gets, I think the goal of that is to make it ultimately international law, some kind of a customary international law that nuclear weapons are illegal. I don't think it's ever going to reach that level, but I appreciate the goal of the people who negotiated that treaty, and I would like to see it succeed. And if ever we could get good faith into this world, you could see a road to having all states, both in conjunction with their NPT obligations and as signatories to that treaty, get to nuclear disarmament. Again, today that's looking extremely unlikely, but I would love to see the world get there if it could. Last, I do think that a fissile material cutoff treaty that we've been trying to negotiate for years is viable and would be helpful. And I would like to see it negotiated at least with no verification regime to start. I think that's the way it could begin. And if we can get states committed to not make more fissile material for nuclear weapons, that's another step towards disarmament. Again, coupled with the fact that the CTBT has to hold, and that's been relatively effective also.
All right, so I've turned all six wishes over to Bob. We'll see what he does with them. So Pat Rhodes, Dave Jonas, thanks for joining me on this episode of NucleCast.
Thank you.
Again.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode. Another interesting episode I would submit to you. Of course, you know, I love Dave. He's a good guy. We've argued on, you know, presidential decision-making before. And so it's always great to have Dave offer his alternative opinion. And Pat, you know, program manager, engineer type. So it's good to hear him because he always has a different perspective about various topics. So enjoyed the discussion. Check out their articles on the Washington Times. I'm sure you'll enjoy them.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NuclearCast.